Our third case this morning is Doe against GTE Corporation.
Gracious, can you hear the meters running?
Mr. Brannett, I assume that this is no reflection on you. Just hold on, we'll wait for the commotion to abate. Mr. Brannett, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Section 230C1 of the Communications Decency Act provides that no interactive computer service provider shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of information provided by others. The central...
I have a preliminary question that may or may not have anything to do with the legal issues involved. Who authorized the taking of these films, and who did it?
Nobody authorized the taking of these films, sir.
You mean spontaneously all of these institutions had cameras put in the locker rooms?
This was done by criminals, basically, who snuck into the locker rooms, put the cameras in gym bags or up on the top of lockers where they couldn't be seen, and without the knowledge of the people in the locker room, videotape them in various states of undress.
The security at all these various institutions are equally lax, I take it?
Apparently.
How many institutions are involved that you could think of?
We know of, I think, at least 6 or 7 that have been identified in the complaint. Our case is just the tip of the iceberg. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of victims, and this has happened not only at universities, but in hotel rooms, in public bathrooms, and in various other locations. So this is just the tip of the iceberg involved in this case. And that, in some respect, demonstrates the importance of the case, because it is the Internet is a very prominent aspect of our society now and is becoming a much more powerful force, both for good and evil, as this case demonstrates. And the question in this case is, what did Congress exactly intend by the use of those words, shall not be treated as a publisher or speaker? Did it intend to really say that no user or provider shall be liable for information provided by others under any cause of action? Or did it mean those words to mean what they say, which is that they shall not be treated as publisher or speaker, thus allowing causes of action such as the plaintiffs, which do not require finding that the defendant is the publisher or speaker, to proceed?
What is the basis for the plaintiff's claim?
Well, there are three...
There's no rule of federal law that I can see that requires GTE to censor the website that it's hosting.
That's correct.
Where is the requirement in state law that GTE censor the websites? This supposed immunity doesn't really make much difference if there's no underlying claim.
These are purely state causes of action.
Yeah, but what is the state claim?
The state claim are two, basically. Well, there's two that involve this particular immunity. One is what I've been calling either contributory or secondary liability, and the other...
That's not a claim that I understand, and negligent entrustment of a chattel doesn't get anywhere because there are no chattels.
Could I just go back? You said it's purely a state... There's no federal claim? I mean, I can see that there are defenses to to a state claim, but that's obviously not enough for federal jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I was addressing...
You do have an argument under the Communications Privacy Act of 86, which we will get to.
Right, exactly, the federal eavesdropping.
There's supplemental jurisdiction from that.
Well, there's a federal eavesdropping action which provides the federal question jurisdiction as well.
Well, but that's a claim against the people who did the placing of the cameras, right? What if I just said, what state statute or state decision is the best for me to look at to see where state law requires an intermediary, an informational intermediary like GTE, to censor the information on its network? Where would you direct me?
Your Honor, I'm not asking this court to find that GTE has a duty to censor or edit. What we are saying is
but
that...
But you are. You're saying they can't create websites. They can't, you know, create the sponsor of this facility, if you will, that was used to inflict harm on these individuals because what? Why can't they? I mean, of course it's horrible and immoral and all the rest, but we're here in a court of law, so we need more.
We are trying to say that, well, first of all, the fundamental torts against the perpetrators, the people that took the videotapes and attempted to market and sell them, is several. Invasion of privacy,
infliction. Let me give you a traditional case. The makers of these videotapes advertise their services, and they put an ad in the Chicago Tribune. Chicago Tribune runs the ad, and people see it, and they buy the tapes. Has the Chicago Tribune violated Illinois law? And if so, how?
Well, I don't know that they have in that circumstance, but if they have materially and substantially assisted another party in committing a tort, they also...
They've run the ad.
Right. So if that constitutes a substantial...
That's the question I'm asking. Is there some state law or state case which would say that by running the ad, by serving as an intermediary, the Trib has violated state law? That's what GTE is doing. It's doing it. It's a different medium over the internet. But the advertising placement, right, fishing for revenues from the sale of this product, is being handled by GTE rather than traditional print media. That's what I'm looking for, because you don't need it. This defense, if it is one, doesn't matter if there's no underlying claim.
Obviously, a new type of case. There are no cases out there addressing the use of the internet or web.
That's why I asked the traditional,
correct,
the traditional medium, a newspaper or any other means by which the goods are advertised and sales made.
Generally speaking, we relied primarily on the terms of the restatement, which have applied this type of liability, what they've called secondary or contributory liability, which adds another realm or another round of defendants to the fundamental tort that's involved.
But the problem is, it seems to me what you're trying very hard to avoid saying is that if the Tribune or, you know, one of those late night TV ads that you see or whatever, is doing anything to contribute, it's because it's publishing something, it's republishing either information about the things, it's helping the tort of defamation or invasion of privacy or torts in that family to occur. But that is, in fact, if that's the claim, then of course the statute does precisely address that kind of claim and say that website providers won't be liable, website operators won't be liable. And some of the other cases out there, like the Fourth Circuit Zaran case, seem to me to be vigorously enforcing that idea.
That's true, but that isn't the circumstance in this case, because what we are talking about here is, with all due respect, there is a chattel involved, the computers, the servers at GTE's facility, which they have entrusted. They have given control, immediate control, of those computers or servers over.
That's kind of like saying that the Chicago Tribune has entrusted the advertiser with the printing press. FBC has entrusted people with its phone network if they try to sell these things over the phone. It may be true that there are wires in the ground, but FBC hasn't entrusted the phone network to the people who try to defraud customers by phone.
But that, well, it is a little bit different in this circumstance where the computer is not under the immediate control of GTE, but rather under the other defendant. There is also the fact that
no more of the computer than the phone line that's being used for the defrauding. It's not like they take over the whole server. A few bytes are flying through the computer that are facilitating this conduct, just like a few, you know, impulses are going through the fiber optic cable or up to the satellite. It's not the whole network.
But the difference, there is a difference in this case, which is that the publication of the objectionable material does not have to happen on the computer or over the internet itself. The mere participation, the allowance of the marketing and advertising of that, those videos on the internet, is a substantial assistance in the commission of the tort. Those videos don't have to be broadcast on the internet.
Then you see, I'm surprised that you don't have any authority for ads in newspapers or phone solicitations or any of the more traditional media. There don't appear to be, so far as I know, any state that views the informational intermediary as liable in those circumstances. I welcome any authority that you have.
Right,
it's essential, I think, to your claim.
But that, I don't know that there has been that kind of situation where you have, as in this case, a knowing involvement in commissions of a tort. I mean, that is not a circumstance that newspapers or TV companies normally put themselves in.
TV companies broadcast late at night, not only Madam Whoever, the psychic who will solve all your personal problems. You think the TV really believes that Madam What's-It has psychic astral knowledge that will solve all your problems? The FTC has, of course, concluded that Madam What's-It is just a colossal fraud, and so we see fewer of these ads. But on your theory, all the TV networks are liable for the amount of money customers were bilked out of by astral nonsense.
I don't know that that's the same situation because there's not...
No, it's not an invasion of privacy. It's a different kind of fraud, and the victims are different. But on your legal theory, the liability of the TV station for lending its assets to the perpetration of what any reasonable person would know was a fraud ought to produce liability for the TV station, shouldn't it?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what your question is, and I apologize.
My question is, I'm trying to figure out what and where one would go for an underlying state law theory of liability.
The theory of liability, I would add, that's not related to, you know, defamation,
right,
or invasion of,
right,
privacy, which are the ones you're
right,
blocked from.
Because your basic claim is that you're not seeking to hold GTE liable just for its just for the kind of role that's covered by this statutory language. You're trying to have some underlying independent tort, and that's what I'm looking for, and wondering where it would show itself in some parallel issues. Maybe we should turn to the Communications Privacy Act of 1986, which is your affirmative claim under federal law and is exempted from 203C1.
And I see we're already in my time of rebuttal, but I can address that question. Basically, Congress has already granted a civil action for those that participate in eavesdropping, which includes not only the actual interception, but also the use or dissemination of conversations that have been eavesdropped. And the question here is one of first impression, at least on the circuit court level, as to whether that includes the concept of aiding and abetting. And our position is that Congress enacts legislation within the context of of the principles of common law, which would include the concept of secondary liability, such as aiding and abetting.
What do you then say about Central Bank of Denver against First Interstate Bank of Denver, a case that held that there is no federal common law doctrine of aiding and abetting in civil liability?
Well, that case involved, I believe, if I know the case, Section 10B of the Sherman Act.
Well,
the
Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
And
but what the court said is that's an instance. There is no general underlying federal aiding and abetting liability. It has to be created by statute. And since Section 10B didn't create such liability, it doesn't exist.
Well, the court
said, why isn't that equally true of the Communications Privacy Act, which doesn't seem to mention aiding and abetting liability?
The court so held in that case because Section 10B itself did not provide any express civil cause of action. The court implied it in the first place and consequently thought that it would be going too far to add an implication upon an implication to add aiding and abetting. I would like to reserve some time for a vote.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Brennan. Mr. Bradbury.
Please, the court. I'm Steve Bradbury. I represent Genuity and GTE Corporation. I'd like to get right to the concept of publication.
Before I get to that, do you have any idea about the question I asked before, where these, what the source of the material might be?
No, I don't, Your Honor. I have no idea who made the original videotapes. I have no idea how the videotapes came into the hands of the other defendants to this action. I just don't know.
Has anybody been to attempt to explore that, or is that still hanging out in midair? Is there any investigation by any agency?
I don't know the answer to that. In this case, the other defendants who were the perpetrators of the copying of the videotapes and creating the advertising to market and sell them didn't show up, didn't answer the complaint. Default judgment was entered against them.
Where are they now?
I have no idea, Your Honor.
They were your customers.
We would
expect you to have some knowledge of your customers.
Well, we had a contact address, which is in the record, and as far as I know, they've disappeared.
Did they pay you?
I don't know for a fact the answer to that question. I think the allegations in the complaint are that we had a contract with them and that we got payment to provide web hosting services.
Did you deny the allegation, or didn't you?
We brought a motion to dismiss. We didn't get to the answer stage, Your Honor.
At some stage, you must have contemplated answering it, though.
Yes, that would be the case if this
was. I move them beyond the record because it doesn't make any difference to the outcome of this proceeding. But I would ask you, do you candidly know whether or not any attempt was made to find out who did it?
In fact, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry. The concept of publication under Section 230 is, I think, well explained in the Zoran opinion, where Chief Judge Wilkinson, I think correctly, in a thorough analysis, said that what Congress intended to immunize was the broadest concept of publication, and he said the statute immunizes, quote, those who are in the business of making their facilities available to disseminate the information gathered by others. That's on page 332.
Wasn't the purpose of this statute, with all due respect to the Fourth Circuit, the recognition by Congress that Internet service providers are truly intermediaries who aren't standing there in the street watching people go by. The flow of information is so fast and so vast that we would actually be doing something very deleterious to the Internet if we imposed this liability. But my follow-on is that rationale falls apart if, as in a case like Duran, there's actual notice given to the ISP. Your facility is being misused in the following way to hurt me. We may not need to reach that issue in this case, but it seems to me one might want to analyze that issue a little bit differently from the way you analyze the totally anonymous flow of information through a server, through websites, which are very difficult and costly to monitor as well.
In many of the prior cases, Your Honor, the defendant did receive notice. For example, in a number of cases where plaintiffs were complaining about information posted on chat room websites, they had notified, for example,
right.
AOL, had told them, this person, your customer, is posting defamatory or invasive or offensive material.
And see, that's what worries me. I know it's there in the prior cases.
Yes.
We haven't had a case like that. I'm
no.
not sure whether that's a wise...
I think the reasoning that really is persuasive here is Chief Judge Wilkinson's, where he said it can't turn on knowledge about the offensive nature of the content, because that would undermine... In other words, liability can't turn on that, because that would undermine the statutory immunity intended by Congress. For example,
the immunity is in, yeah, the immunity is in C2, and the actual immunity just says that informational intermediaries who choose to censor can't be liable.
No.
Why does that imply that intermediaries are free not to pay any attention?
There is,
to the harm that their stuff does.
There is an equally robust immunity in C1, which says no...
So you say, but and C1 reads to me like a definitional clause, not an independent grant of immunity.
So none of the other cases that we cite, the Zoran opinion, the Bassel case, the Green opinion from the mm-hmm. Third Circuit, Ben Ezra from the Tenth Circuit, none of them would have found immunity if there were not immunity flowing from Section 230C1.
That's
in combination
the discussion
with...
Yeah. we're trying to have with you, because yeah. we are not in the...
It may be right, may be wrong, but we ought to discuss whether it's right.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's why I would direct you to Judge Wilkinson's opinion in Zoran, where he, at length, goes through this and explains that if liability turned on knowledge about the offensive content, and you were able to exercise control to suppress it or stop it, then the perverse results of that for the growth of the Internet would be as follows. If
look, that might be fine if we were committee chairman of the Congress committee, but we're supposed to be applying the statute Congress actually enacted rather than making some freewheeling policy for the Internet. And the statute Congress actually enacted creates immunity for people who choose to censor, but does not seem to create immunity for people who choose not to. In other words, it creates an incentive to get rid of bad information.
Which also implies that there are ways of getting rid of bad information, and many responsible ISPs are doing exactly that.
Your Honor, if you look at the findings, if you look at the policies that are stated on the face of the statute, and if you look at Section 230C1 in combination with the provision that says
every
no...
Every time somebody says, don't really look at the language, look at policy, I get very nervous.
No, here the policy is stated on the face of the statute, and so are the findings, and an equal goal of Congress here was to preserve the unregulated nature of the Internet and the growth of information on the Internet of all kinds.
Let's qualify that, because yes, Congress was interested in the legitimate growth of the Internet, but there are dozens of other statutes in which Congress has made it very clear that abuses of the Internet are frowned upon. So if you send child pornography over the Internet, you've committed a crime, and so on. There are more than one
statute. And heaven forfend, you should let children use the Internet in libraries or anything like that.
Directing back to Judge Wilkinson, here's what he said. If you're just a distributor, you're not exercising any editorial control, you're not even holding yourself out as exercising control, okay? So you're just a passive web host, like GTE here, and you have knowledge because someone tells you, hey, that content from your customer X is offensive, defamatory, child pornography X. What did Congress intend to create an incentive for here? If anybody is given any notice, Judge Wilkinson pointed out, and liability then flowed because that person is not immunized under Section 230, they would immediately shut down that website. They wouldn't even investigate it. If somebody brought any information to their attention, boom. They would suppress information and content on the Internet. Much of the information flowing on the Internet would be suppressed. On the other hand, what would their incentive be with respect to knowledge of the contents of their website? They put their head in the sand. They would make no effort. They would do everything they could not to know what the content was, and that is just the opposite of Congress's intended goal of incentivizing ISPs to actually control content.
Even though they know that they are safe if they try to take actions to censor, because that is what the statute says. Did you see in the news, by the way, that MSN is going to shut down its chat rooms in quite a few other countries? they're so concerned with the abuse of these devices?
Actually, some internet service providers like AOL, like MSN, like Prodigy, in the Prodigy case, which gave rise to this statute, find that it is an advantage in the marketplace to market the fact that they exercise control and provide parental control tools, for example.
Which is why it's so hard to buy the idea that in the actual notice situation, if somebody communicates to GTE or the ISP or anybody that, you know, somebody's sending death threats about me over the internet, that when you then respond and try to take some action, you aren't fully immune.
But, Your Honor, the Prodigy case, which gave rise to the statute, and many of the prior cases that have applied the immunity have involved situations where the internet service provider took no action, learned about it, was put on notice of it, and took no action.
And I am simply telling you that I don't find that a fully satisfactory. I mean, I think it's an important question to think about. Just as I say, I have great respect for the other judges, but it's a complex area.
Well, of course, I obviously would. This is the first time this circuit has obviously dealt with this statute. I fully expect this court will issue a thoughtful and thorough opinion setting forth your ideas. And I'm not asking.
But then when you file a petition for rehearing, you won't be describing it as thoughtful and thorough anymore.
It might be a petition for certiorari, but I hope not. But I do believe the reasoning, particularly of Judge Wilkinson, is highly persuasive. And the other circuits that have followed have made it clear that 230 bars all manner of causes of action. Whatever creative tort theories plaintiffs can try to engineer, all of them that relate to you failed to exercise control that you could have exercised somehow over the dissemination of harmful or offensive information on your system, any tort theory of liability that raises that as the essential claim is barred by Section 230. And it doesn't matter if the internet service provider actually does exercise some input into the content and some editorial involvement in the content. Many of the prior cases have involved much more involvement and active participation in the editing and production developing of the content than GTE is alleged to have done here, which is really no well-pleaded facts about GTE's involvement at all in the particular harmful content of these websites. So, for example, you've got...
Okay, that's a whole different ground for you, because this complaint... doesn't even say on information and belief. It says we might someday have information and belief.
Yes, Your Honor. And on motion
so
to dismiss, you can't credit that as a well-pleaded allegation. The only clear allegation is that GTE or Genuity, in fact, as a web host, provided technical support for the web servers. The chattel argument, by the way, as the court pointed out, that argument could be made in any of these prior cases, where you've got defendants like AOL that own and operate their web servers on which the websites are posted. If a web server is chattel, they could exercise control over it. So all of the plaintiff's claims involve an allegation that we negligently failed to exercise control over our web server to prevent the dissemination of this offensive material. We think that's squarely immunized under Section 230 as correctly interpreted and applied by consistently all of the courts that have addressed the issue. And I would invite this court, in its wisdom, to apply the statute in the same way. Perhaps, Your Honor, I should address the federal eavesdropping claim. I think that the court is exactly correct, or Judge Easterbrook, I believe you're exactly correct, that there is no aiding and abetting liability under the civil liability.
There's no aiding and abetting liability. I've just asked a few questions.
I understand, Your Honor, but it's important to point out.
Of course, in another case, Boehm against Quranic Literacy Institute, this court did find aiding and abetting liability under a federal statute. It's really a statute-by-statute inquiry.
Yes, Your Honor, I would concede that. Here, the eavesdropping statute is a criminal statute. Section 2511, the underlying substantive violation, that's a criminal provision. And what Section 2520 says, which is the civil liability provision, the civil liability provision says that a person harmed by a violation of 2511 can obtain civil liability against that person who committed the violation of 2511.
But of course, Boehm was the same sort of thing. Boehm involved the statutes to prohibit international terrorism, and there's also a civil liability provision for somebody who's a victim of international terrorism, and the evaluation of that statute was one which led to a finding that there was aiding and abetting liability.
Well, Your Honor, I have a second argument here.
Okay.
My first argument is Chief Judge Koukouras got it exactly right that there is no aiding and abetting civil liability under the statute. But my second argument is, even if Section 2520 were held to embody or codify an aiding and abetting concept, that plaintiff here, on the face of the complaint, has plainly failed to allege that Genuity's involvement as the provider of web hosting services rises to the level of aiding and abetting. The primary authority they rely on to flesh out the nature of that aiding and abetting claim that they rely on is a 1979 Pennsylvania District Court opinion, a Kraft opinion, which quotes in a footnote a Supreme Court discussion of aiding and abetting liability in the criminal context that held that, quote, an aider and abettor must associate himself with the venture, participate in it as in something that he wishes to bring about, and seek by his action to make it succeed. All the other cases they've cited for aiding and abetting liability have a similar standard. For example, Judge Posner's opinion for this court in the Eastern Trading versus Revco case, that applied a concept of aiding and abetting in the sense of assisting the fraud and wanting it to succeed. And there, the defendant had actually financially benefited because he got commissions for making the fraudulent trades. The same sort of standard applies in each of the other cases.
That's why I'm asking you whether you got paid. Go ahead, but your time is
but
not anyway.
Here, Your Honor, the important thing is that they haven't alleged that we participated in the production of the videotapes or the marketing of the videotape, and GTE didn't. There's no allegation that GTE profited from the sale of the videotapes. In other words, these folks were simply customers like any website customers of GTE. Well, but Your Honor, the profit was not linked to, did not depend on the sale of the videotapes. And I believe...
Like any aider and abettor, it was indirect.
No, Your Honor. For example, if they cite the case, the Illinois Supreme Court case of Page versus Keyes, where they said, here's how they defined aiding and abetting. When one assists in the commission of a wrongful act, if done for his benefit, and he avails himself of the fruits of such improper conduct, he is liable as if he himself had committed the wrongful act. We didn't there's no allegation that we participated in the fruits of the wrongful act.
I am generally familiar with the aiding and abetting statutes in the criminal context.
I'm sure, Your Honor, that you're much more familiar than I with any of these concepts. But
no, that's not true, but there is true about the aiding and abetting.
Very well. I think the important point is they haven't alleged anywhere the active participation, that GT encouraged it, that we wanted them to sell the videotapes, that we got the fruits or the benefits of the sale of the videotape. And for all these reasons, Your Honor, I think the judgment of the district court should plainly be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bradbury. Anything further, Mr. Brenner? In light of the questioning, we'll also give you an extra 2 minutes.
I think that the court's questioning of opposing counsel points out the main reasons why the Section 230 does not apply to the causes of action that have been alleged against GTE. First, they're trying to say that finding them liable would cause them to put their head in the sand, but as Justice Easterbrook pointed out, the exact opposite is true. They can get absolute immunity from that by actually trying to filter that's the whole purpose and strategy that Congress set up, is to encourage people to actively filter by granting them the benefit of blanket immunity. And they wanted to put a price on the other side of that, of inaction, by allowing certain types of liability against them.
But you haven't alleged that GTE actually knew that these videotapes were being marketed on the website, have you?
Yes, we have, Your Honor. We've set forth allegations in the complaint.
Well, that they created the website, right?
Well, not only that, but that the websites themselves, on their very face, say that they that they're hidden video taken without the knowledge of the people on the videos.
So you have to read the content before
Correct.
You get there, and that's where technically setting up a website isn't the same thing as sitting down there and reading the screen.
There are additional allegations in the complaint that during first of all, they had those websites on their own server, so they had access to it. Second, in routine maintenance, they would have had to set up or view those websites in order to be able to repair them.
That sounds like right at the core of what Congress was worried about, because you could say that about every single website on a server. And if now you're saying that the burden on ISPs is to go, or website creators, is to go and check every single website on a particular network, it's impossible. It can't be done.
Well, and that's why there's the knowing requirement. It isn't a question of whether they have a duty to do that, but once they
have
that knowledge...
That's the only reason for thinking they do know, because they might have browsed through at some point.
No, they would have been doing that as their function as
Which
a host of
the website.
Which is
true of every website they're hosting, every single website.
Indeed, it's true of every chat room on AOL.
But that still allows them to be held liable for knowing that there are tortious acts being committed on their property. And they have entrusted that property to others, knowing that they will continue to commit those torts. And that, in defense of the plaintiff's position, Your Honor, the whole point here has always been Section 230C1, whether that grants immunity. And I see my time is up, if I can just finish my point. The defendants have never contested the substantive nature of the plaintiff's complaint. They've never said that we had not stated a cause of action. And for that reason, our entire briefing, both in the district court and this court, have focused on application of Section 30C1 mm-hmm. and the fact that...
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.